Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Hello, I'm Peter Johnson. Thank you for joining us today on Extended, your aviation and aerospace radio station. Today, I'm joined by my co-presenter, Gareth Stringer, Managing Editor at Global Aviation Resource. Gareth, how are you?
I'm good, Peter. How are you?
Bloody brilliant. I'm really excited about this one. It's a year in the waiting.
Hey, this guy is so busy. This is what it takes. How long you have to wait to get him on the show?
Yeah. Just before we talk to and introduce our guest, Gareth, Gar's had a bit of a renaissance recently. Great pictures, articles, Puma retirement. That one featured in particular was very popular.
Yeah, it's deliberate. I think the site sat there with not much content for quite a long time, but it never stopped. Just like the podcast, sometimes life gets in the way, and the guys have kind of all reconnected a little bit on WhatsApp, as people do these days, and we've decided to give everything a bit of a push, and we've got a few ideas for the future as well, so watch this space.
Excellent.
It's a shame it has to be a retirement that kicks it into action, but it's always a nice excuse to look at, you know, a type and get some stories together. Yeah. And the Puma stuff, some of what we've managed to get was great.
Really
special
enjoyed
forces
it.
Stuff and all of that, it was good.
Yeah, well done. Well, our guest today should be no stranger to anyone if you listen to our content in the past. He was, of course, last with us on the very brilliant and hilarious episode 157, which was Gareth's debrief, and that was Mike Napier and Tug Wilson. Today, Mike's here to talk to us about his latest book, published by Osprey, called Over Cold War Seas, NATO and Soviet Naval Aviation, 1949 to 1989. He describes the naval air power deployed by NATO, the Warsaw Pact, and neutral countries throughout the Cold War. For all those Cold War geeks out there, this one's for you. Mike, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me back. Pleasure to be with you again.
What is this, three or four times you've been with us now, I think
it's something like that. Yes. Yeah.
It's going to
be a habit.
Yeah, it is. And as I said, the session you and Tug had with Gareth was one of my favourite all-timers, I've got to say.
It was great fun.
Yeah.
I think you get a blue plaque outside your house after five appearances or something, so we're nearly there.
Red.
I'm in there then.
Yeah, I'll have to be red. But Mike, just for those who maybe don't know you, new to the program, or haven't gone as far back as 2022, to listen to you on our last podcast, can you give us just a brief overview of your background and your aviation career?
Yes, I joined the RAF back in 1978. They got a last bit of the Cold War, and I ended up flying Tornado GR1s. I was based out at Bruggen, and I did a couple of tours there. A tour as a tactics instructor at the tactical weapons unit, flying the Hawk, back to Bruggen again, the Tornado. A couple of staff tours, left the RAF. So having done almost 20 years worth of the RAF, then joined British Airways. So I flew the DC-10, the Boeing 777, then the Airbus 320, and finished up on Boeing 787, so about 20 years worth of being an airline pilot. And I got into writing books about 10 years ago now, actually, just a bit more than that. Started off with a squadron history of one of the squadrons that I had been on in the RAF, and it kind of started from there. And it sort of, it started sort of setting career now as an author, really, because I was sort of ploughing them out. But it's all great fun, and it keeps me off the streets and keeps me from bothering old ladies and all that sort of stuff. So, all good fun.
Now, we're going to come back to your what's on your to-do list, because you are pretty prolific. But tell us, why this one? Where did this one come from? Because you were, very much an RAF pilot, and I know you've been quite prolific in writing about various areas of aviation, but Cold War naval aviation, quite a niche area to focus on.
Yeah, a bit bizarre, really, for a landlubber like me. But no, well, what happened was that 5 years ago, 2020, I read a book called in Cold War Skies. Now, that was the brainchild of a guy called Jasper Spencer-Smith. And Jasper has been kind of an editor I'm going to try, the words just escape from me, but he sort of come up with various ideas and punted them forwards to the publishers, and his idea was in Cold War Skies, which we did, and that's actually worked out quite well, was quite successful, but because that's such a massive subject, we didn't bother doing the, or didn't include, shall I say, it's probably a more politely way of putting it, didn't include the naval stuff because there just wasn't space for it. And so the idea always was we'd finished up with one, a book that did do the naval stuff. So that's where it came from. And it's just taken us 5 years to get round to doing it.
Now,
and here we are.
Now, it is a super book. It's particularly prominent. To me, it stood out very much in the from the photographs, and we maybe can come back to that. But one of the challenges that I had when I picked the book up is, I wonder how Mike's going to structure this. How did you go about thinking about the best way of structuring it? Because you have to move between, you know, Soviet, NATO, neutral, time, and then all the different methodologies and approaches. And it's quite an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, it is. Well, what I did was, in fact, on this one, was just follow the same pattern that I had done for the Cold War Skies bit. So I decided that, because I'd like history to be sort of chronological, you know, rather than zipping backwards and forwards. That said, we had to sort of take the neutral people out and have them separate. But everything else, I tried to do it as a sort of chronological story. And again, depending on the way that things seem to work in almost like 5 year cycles. So I've done a chapter for covering each decade, and then within that decade, it's kind of split. Sort of, you know, the first 5 years were the Allies, the first 5 years were with the Soviet stroke Warsaw Pact, and then back to the Allies for the next 5 years. And I've sort of done it that way. And I think that follows logically, I think, because it does follow a sort of chronological order. And it also does alternate between, you know, the contemporary things almost on each side, and then moving on to the next stage of it. So that's really where that sort of idea came from. And then at the end of it, I just gone through the neutral and online countries, just sort of, you know, one after the other, because I don't think it's not quite as critical in understanding the big picture to do to have that really to have that chronology. Is there such a word as chronological? Anyway,
chronological order, I suppose. We all know what that means.
So it doesn't. So it wasn't so important. So really, it's just a matter of because they're little sort of very much a niche things. So just a quick look at each one after the other.
Now, one of the things that's really fascinating about the whole Cold War naval aviation arena is the different approaches that the NATO countries took. Even within the NATO countries, there were different approaches. Should they use carriers? Could they afford carriers? What were their tactics? You know, and the Soviets were very different. How did let's kick it off after the war? How did this whole naval aviation sector evolve post World War II?
Yeah, before answering that, there's two things that have to be said. And one is that what I discovered doing this is that you can't just construct airplanes without following two things, which are the aircraft carrier, as you've just mentioned, and the submarine, which is the other thing, because all those three elements are tied up completely together with the way they go. And the second thing is that if you look at a map of NATO and the Warsaw Pact, what you notice is that the Warsaw Pact is land. It's all, you know, it's completely continuous land from one end of Russia to the end of the, you know, where the German border was. Whereas if you look at a map of NATO, there's this big thing in the middle of it called the Atlantic. So, I mean, the clue's in the name, isn't it? North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So geography means that there's a very, very different approach between the Soviets on the one hand and NATO on the other. But yes, what you're right, at the end of the war, there were two massive navies. The two big navies of the world were the US Navy and the Royal Navy. And they had both fought slightly different wars in that the US Navy had basically fought an amphibious
war against the Japanese going across Ireland. So they were fighting a force which was heavy in capital ships, but had very, very few submarines. So there wasn't much of a submarine threat, but lots of capital ships and other aircraft carriers, and lots of supporting ground forces doing doing amphibious landings. So their idea was get aircraft carriers out, which can then go off and sink other battleships, other aircraft carriers, and can also go and drop bombs on people while the Marines are doing their landing, hitting the beach and all the rest of it. On the other hand, the Royal Navy, the focus there was in the North Atlantic, where the idea was to get convoys across the North Atlantic, and they were there fighting a Navy which didn't have much of capital ships, but had a load of submarines. And so their emphasis was on the anti-submarine warfare. So they're completely two different things. Yeah, we're now using an aircraft carrier to have aircraft flying around that can then hunt submarines, as opposed to one that's out to either get capital ships or to support amphibious operations. So two very, very different approaches to what you might use an aircraft carrier for. On the other hand, the Soviets hadn't really had a navy, hadn't needed to, because it, as I say, it was basically all land there. So massive armies and air forces, but no need for a navy, very small navy. And so again, their requirements for aviation was basically long range airplanes, because they had to go miles and miles and miles to go and hunt down whatever the NATO people were doing, but either over the Pacific or the North Atlantic. And so that's why they have gone that way. Until recently, I mean, the first proper aircraft carrier, I think, was Kuznetsov, which is sort of post Cold War almost. They had the through deck cruisers before with Forger from the sort of mid 70s through the 80s, but I wouldn't describe them as proper aircraft carriers. So again, their strength was in massive amounts of submarines with the threats that they posed. So that's where the sort of you get this completely different approach. The Americans very much into using the carrier the concept of the carrier strike group, where you send the carrier in to support, particularly in the NATO environment, northern Norway. So you're landing the mobile force and the Marines everything up in north Norway to stop the Russians from breaking out from the Kola Peninsula and supporting operations there. So that was their big thing. And meanwhile, we were concentrating, and particularly the Invincible class and stuff like that, and anti-submarine stuff. So that, in a nutshell, is the way it is.
Now, there was one other. There's one other major development as well that comes through during the Cold War. Before we jump into airplanes and talking about some of the dynamics of the aircraft, and that's the evolution of rotary craft, of helicopters as well. Because obviously post-war everything was pretty much fixed wing, from attack to sub hunting, and then of course we saw the evolution of the rotary wing come in through the Cold War as well, and that was a very interesting dynamic that you thread through the book, because it's quite challenging where the roles of fixed wing aircraft hand over to rotary aircraft.
Yes, and it's something where the helicopter really found its niche. It was ideal for going off and dropping a sonar, and particularly and operating off of small ships. So very much easier to operate than fixed wing airplanes, and an awful lot more flexible. So and really it was the navies who sort of bought into the helicopter. I mean, navies across the world, the Russians as well, in a way that air forces and armies didn't in the same way. So you're absolutely right. The helicopter has been is another sort of crucial dynamic to the whole naval maritime scene, really.
And how then post war did the aircraft evolve to, obviously we saw the introduction of the jet engine, massive change in technology there. But predominantly after the end of the war, it was, it was propeller-driven aircraft and that sort of thing. What were some of the key aircraft developments post-war?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right. The jet engine was the big one, but initially, yes, all the carrier-borne aircraft were propeller-borne, propeller-driven, because jet engines needed sort of massive acceleration times, didn't produce very much power initially, and so the first sort of carrier jets were fairly dodgy machines, really. The thing that I found interesting was the fact that for example, in the Korean War, the Americans were using jet aircraft off their carriers by that stage, pretty much all, you know, all jet aircraft, with the exception of the Sky Raider, which could carry an awful lot more than a jet airplane could. But the British were still flying propeller-driven aircraft, you know, Sea Furies and stuff like that. And at that stage, the American aircraft were all straight-winged jet aircraft. And so the swept wing, which came in sort of it's probably mid-50s, came in. So the Americans were operating swept wing aircraft when we had just started with the things like the Attacker and that, which were still straight winged aircraft. So we were kind of really were right behind, you know, 5 years behind them right from the start, really. And I guess that's that very sort of quick transition from some, you know, the first generation to then you're looking at things like by the end of the 1950s, you know, like the F-4 Phantom, like the A6 Sky Raider. No, I don't mean that at all. All the things like the Vigilante, the A5, and a huge, great, you know, really powerful jet aircraft, in the space of just 10 years. And you think about the Phantom, and that stayed in service pretty much right to the end of the Cold War. So it just shows what a fantastic design it was.
Yeah. And you also had the differences in the types of carriers. Obviously, the Americans had large carriers that could take things like the Vigilante. Yeah. That was not a route that the Royal Navy went, predominantly through cost and, the demobbing of the services after the war. And the pressure on price and cost and that sort of thing. So we saw different aircraft developments, didn't we? So, you know, for us in the UK, we saw things like the Fairey Gannet and that sort of thing coming into play, whereas the Americans had slightly more scope, should we say, to use more powerful aircraft.
Yeah, well, I mean, we did operate. I mean, we were operating Phantoms and Buccaneers off Ark Royal. Buccaneers off quite a few more carriers before that. The Scimitar, another utterly British and useless aeroplane. we were operating big aeroplanes, but just from much smaller carriers. As you say, the Americans had the money to go big, and went big, and would, you know, the carriers with an air wing of, you know, 80 plus aeroplanes, whereas our ones were very much smaller. But again, that goes around the whole thing of the concept of the carrier strike group, which again sort of was, the book talks about the North Atlantic, particularly the NATO, but actually if you look in the Pacific, that's the Korean War, which is probably when the Americans started this sort of concept of using aircraft carriers as floating runways off the coast. And of course, then Vietnam followed much the same thing. So, you know, you had the sort of first, 3 years of the 50s, and then most of the 60s with the how to using airplanes in or aircraft carrier strike groups in that way. Whereas we had not gone in the same way and didn't have the same experience, and a much, much smaller fleet of much, much smaller ships. But nevertheless, I mean, you know, as I say, you know, Scimitar, Buccaneer, mix, Sea Vixens, sort of were there right through the 60s, and they're really quite, you know, pretty capable airplanes, but just in much smaller numbers. Probably about half, I think, the size, you know, probably 30 to almost 40 for an air wing, as opposed to the 80 you're talking about on a US carrier.
Now, Mike, did I read somewhere that there was an aircraft carrier that had over 100 aircraft on it?
Yeah. I think the more modern ones, I can't remember which class off the top of my head it is, having not read the book recently.
I mean, I can't.
For the reason we said.
I can't imagine. So
getting on to that, you know, these really big super carriers, and I can't remember what Enterprise, because Enterprise was the biggest, and it may well have been Enterprise, but certainly I think the recent George Bush ones, I think it's George Bush class ones are huge things as well.
And so,
massive.
And let's talk about then how the Soviet Union approached naval aviation after the war. You mentioned land-based predominantly. That led to an awful lot of long-range recon anti-submarine type aircraft, being used. Tell us a bit about the Soviet evolution.
Yeah, so the Soviets and the sort of Soviet naval aviation and Soviet long-range aviation, which is the Air Force side of it, kind of both went the same way of starting off with twin-engine, the Ilyushin Beagle, quite short range in reality, but then moving swiftly on to the Tu-16, the Badger, the Myasishev, 3M, the Bison, and the one we all love, the Tu-95 Bear. Long range airplanes that could fly from, you know, all the way from the bases up near Murmansk, around the North Cape, and then down through Norway, across the, you know, Norwegian Sea, and into the Atlantic. And then across, you know, landing in Cuba if needs be. So they needed to have these long-range airplanes in order to have the reach, in order to... And the airplanes basically were used to locate these carrier strike groups. Because initially, that's what that was the role, was to... They said, right, we obviously the threat is the carrier strike groups. We need to take these out. And so the idea was to send your reconnaissance aircraft out, which would not only find the targets, but then send that back to particularly the submarines, missile armed submarines, and then which would then fire the missiles, and then the aircraft would then give you a mid course update for the missiles. So this was a kind of very integrated land or air sea campaign, if you like. And then that later, as the threat switched more from aircraft carriers more towards submarines. Again, then the long-range airplanes were used to hunt the submarines as well. So, given the distance from the, you know, the Atlantic or the operating areas, they need long-range airplanes to be able to do that. And for example, to not so much to cover the Baltics, that's a reasonably short thing, but the Mediterranean, again, if you're operating from Russia, you need a long-range airplane to be able to do that. So that's why they went down that route.
Mike, how important is it to remember in a historical context that we're talking about not just projecting or defending yourself in a conventional sense, but during the Cold War, actually talking about countries potentially annihilating one another with the sort of nuclear threat? That's quite a shift, isn't it, from sort of 1945 into the Cold War? It's a big difference. I know we talked about it a little bit with your career as a tornado pilot. You know, it was a very real threat at the time, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, very, very much so. You've hit the nail on the head there, because of course the submarine and missile technology advanced into the 1960s. You know, suddenly we've got ballistic missile submarines. And so suddenly from the original concept of air-launched bombs, you know, it was dropping over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we're into missiles fired from aircraft. And then suddenly, the submarines are a better way of doing it, and so both the Soviets and the Americans and ourselves, you know, as well. I mean, we went from Vulcan with Blue Steel across to using the submarines and Polaris. Suddenly the submarine becomes massively important in terms of strategic strategic issues, and in terms of, as you say, weapons of mass destruction, and making sure you try and get, you know, try and find them. Because I mean, think about the submarine, the beauty of the submarine was that it was so difficult to find, so you could stick your missiles in it and nobody'd know where it was. So the great thing that became so important was hunting them down and finding them. So from both sides, both ourselves trying to find theirs and the Soviets trying to find our ones.
And that was a real sort of cat and mouse game, isn't it? There's something slightly romantic, if you like, in a way, about that thought of the submarine sitting silently, you know, and the threats above pinging it and trying to avoid one another. And I guess the reality was it was probably quite like that, wasn't it?
I think it was. And I mean, one of the things, you know, back to my Air Force days, we regarded ourselves in Fast Jet Force, you know, as being the front line and the sharpest of the sharp and all the rest of it. But the people who were actually doing the real day-to-day job were the Nimrod guys, whom we obviously laughed at. No, that's not fair. But they were doing the real thing. They were actually going off and hunting these things down and following nuclear submarines around and about with, you know, in different ways. They would launch in the middle of the night with no lights and no radio calls, and just head off at, you know, not very high over the sea and pitch up somewhere off the North Cape to rendezvous and find a submarine And then come back at the end of the day and land with no, you know, with no transmissions or anything. So nobody knew they were there even. Dropping these patterns of buoys, and it depended, you know, what sort of submarine you were after. If it was a, diesel one, you're listening for. I think the diesel ones actually were, because they were diesel electric, they were actually quite quiet when they weren't on the surface. So unless they were snorkeling or something like that, in which case you could find them. The nuclear powered ones were a bit easier because they had a cooling system which had a distinctive noise to it, so you could actually listen into that. But again, if you dropped your if you were too low, then they'd be able to hear you, so you had to be quite high up. But obviously, if you drop the buoys in from great height, there'd be massive splash. So it's trying to get sort of mixture, so you could drop these things in a pattern in the right place to find out where they were and who they were, without them knowing that you were there. Unless, of course, you wanted them to know that you were on top of them, in which case you send an active boy in and they go, oh, my goodness me. it was a real, as you can say, exactly that, cat and mouse, and hunting for real, very much for real, real nuclear-armed submarines that were really there, ready to go if the balloon ever went up. So, massive important thing to do.
And Mike, one of the things that spurred me on thinking about different methodologies, well, something you just mentioned there is you talked about the Nimrods. They were RAF aircraft.
Yes.
How did the different countries and their different structures tackle naval aviation? So obviously you've got the Royal Navy and the Fleet Air Arm, and of course we sort of had that bit in the middle called Coastal Command for a while, and then you had the RAF on the other side delivering a service. How did the various NATO and Soviet navies and air forces tackle that in different ways over the sea, shall we say, the challenge over the sea?
I think that it was, although, as you've pointed out, I mean, the Nimrods are RAF aircraft, of what originally had been Coastal Command became Strike Command, and the Shackletons had been around before that. The US, in the US side, it was actually the US Navy that did all the anti-submarine stuff. So all their Neptunes and then Orions were all run by the Navy. And the Norwegians, actually not so the Norwegians, certainly the Dutch, also operating Neptunes and Orions. And that was the Dutch Navy that did that. I think I'm right saying off the top of my head. Over the sea, operationally, whatever the different sort of domestic and command arrangements, actually operationally, and this is the great sort of strength of NATO, is a unified military command. And so operationally, all these things work together absolutely seamlessly. So you'd get a submarine that might leave Murmansk that we picked up by, an American P3 that would then get picked up by, would be taken over by a Nimrod, but then maybe a Dutch P3 would take over that, or then perhaps a Norwegian something. And so it would just be handed over and handed over with standard procedures and standard methodology, and everybody understanding exactly what was going on. So, although the management of the aircraft was different, the way they operated was exactly the same or exactly compatible at any way. That was the truly impressive thing, I think, about NATO, really, was it could do all that.
Yeah.
Whether it still can or not, I have no idea. But
whether it will, we'll watch and wait.
Well, I never knew that. This is the kind of response we love to get from readers every time we publish an edition of The Aviation Historian, the journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of aviation history. Topics such as a secret RAF plan for a trans-global bombing raid on mainland Argentina during the Falklands War in 1982. Or the inner workings of the Lewis machine gun. Or the use of unmanned B-17 Flying Fortress drones in post-war atomic weapons testing. Or what it was really like to be an Imperial Airways passenger in the 1930s. And now, after 50 quarterly issues over the past 12 and a half years, we are going annual. The same fresh, stimulating, high-quality content, but in a different package. Plus, we're doing books and specials. The Aviation Historian. We're print. We're digital. We're flying history for connoisseurs. But we're not on sale in newsagents. Find out more at theaviationhistorian.com.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
One more question just before we get to talk about some aircraft, and I want to come back to the book, because although the book is a chronology of that whole naval aviation in the Cold War, you dip in and out with some personal stories as well, which I found quite fascinating. I particularly liked the TU 90, the Bear story.
Oh, yes.
The new naval aviator on the Bear. Can you just give us a little bit of a flavour for where some of those stories came from and why you chose to use that sporadically throughout the book?
I think, again, it was following on from the pattern that we'd established with Cold War Skies, in that it's just quite nice or interesting to get a first-hand "I was there" story. I think it just gives you a bit more of a dimension and puts things in sort of context a bit better. So, yeah, and also if you just read what I write, it gets a bit boring after a bit. So somebody else's stuff in there to just liven it up a bit. What I wanted to do was trying to get a sort of a mix of just different experiences, different aeroplanes. So we've got a Canadian tracker pilot and various other bits and pieces. I wasn't able to get much in the way of US Navy stuff, and I wish I had done. But there's some quite interesting stuff for a P3 guy doing his, I think, landing in Keflavik in the Crosswind or something. And a bit more kind of the hands-on flying type thing as well. But yes, you're right. The Soviet one was a guy called Sergei Lavrov, who was actually a translator. That was his job, and I'm not sure he was actually in the Navy.
Okay.
He got attached to the Navy for this this particular. It was the first time that the Soviets have flown long-range aircraft or military aircraft into the Americas, Cuba, but clearly they'd had MiGs and things in there during the Cuban Missile Crisis. But there's this sort of this airplane to go there, and he was added to the crew as an interpreter. He spoke English, and what they obviously didn't work out was actually in Cuba they spoke Spanish, so I'm not quite sure how much use he was. But yes, there's sort of he goes off in this TU-95, and they start teasing him by pretending to be in a panic that they're about to be shot down, and the alarm's going off everywhere, and the lightning turns up at that. But actually, it's just the way the pilot waves at them. And then they arrive. Actually, I think I cut the story slightly because they landed in the wrong place initially.
Is in there. Yeah.
Yeah. So they had to quickly get airborne and land at the place that was 10 miles down the road where everybody's waiting for them.
Yeah.
And then when they came to take off, it was quite interesting. They're taking off at 4 o'clock in the morning and went charging off down the runway. And it was so hot and sweaty that they weren't getting much power off the engines. Like, it just clipped the trees at the far end pretty much.
Yeah.
And when he went back there a few months later, they said, "Oh, we thought you're going to fly into the trees."
It's a nice touch. The stories add a nice flavour to the book. So,
I just one more if I might say. A mate of mine through training who was in the Navy, went to sea Harriers, Tim Eastow, wrote a fantastic, it was about 2,000 words of account of being flying a sea Harrier on an exercise up in the North Atlantic. But I'd only had room for 500 words. So I had to, I felt like, that's a real heathen. I had carving it all down to something. I sent him a note. I'm really sorry, I've had to edit it, and I got this sort of very terse one-liner back saying, "Well, that's not what we're going to do." even those 500 words are brilliant to kind of really capture what it's like to be in a Sea Harrier cockpit. It's just a shame that I had to vandalise it really and get rid of most of it, because it was good stuff.
I just on that, Mike, single seat away that far out over the ocean, single engine as well. That's pretty extreme stuff, isn't it?
Well, it is, and the airplane itself, I think, was fairly basic in terms of what it had, the nav kit and everything else. Those guys really did a fantastic job. Much respect for the Sea Harrier mates with what they got up to.
So let's talk some airplanes. As I mentioned earlier on, fabulous photography. Some new photos in there. It's quite rich in photos. So whilst there's an awful lot of text, I think it, the book's 300 odd pages. There's a fair number of photos in there. You must have had a favourite airframe in your mind when you were writing this, or you discovered, surely.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes and no. In many ways, each one became a favourite as you looked into it, because there's so many. In fact, if I was to choose my favourite, it would probably be the airships, because I have no idea that they were still finding things around in the early 1960s. These huge, great airships with radars actually inside the envelope, and some of them with radar, height finder radars sat on top of it and stuff like that. I think the Phantom, I think, will always be that's the iconic airplane of the Cold War, really, and very much of both overland, but also the naval aviation as well. And I think the Royal Navy ones, that's a fantastic colour scheme they had. It's just a beautiful looking machine. And that's pretty good for a Phantom, which is a pretty pug ugly airplane anyway. So actually, to make it beautiful was good. But all of them had their own little sort of interesting bits and pieces. And I think that was the fascinating thing, particularly in the sort of 1950s. All these airplanes that came in and lasted 2 years and got chucked out again were Sky Rays and all these other bizarre looking machines that were fascinating, and a lot of them you looked at and think, well, what were they thinking when they produced these things? And then you get onto the sort of great favorites through the sort of late 70s, Tomcats and Intruders and stuff, which again sort of classic airplanes, which again sort of saw service for the 20 plus years after the Cold War as well, so really did last the course.
There's a fabulous three-page spread that's got an F4, an A7, and an F14 on it, and it's just Gareth, you must have a favourite from the book somewhere.
Yeah, I just think Cold War is just such a rich, period of history for aviation, wasn't it? That we can look back at. Sorry to bring the Phantom up again. Mark, good job. Tug's not here.
It is.
One of the Robert Priest's book, F4 Phantom, a pilot story. Yeah. He talks about some of those long exercises out up to the going north and keep going north, and talking about bears and cubs and Russian aircraft launching kangaroo missiles at the UK and all of that. And I just think that's what I kind of always think of, is Phantoms launching from Lucas to intercept bears and stuff like that.
There's a great picture of an F-22 intercepting a bear as well. Is it off Alaska? We don't get to see many pictures of that part of the world. We normally, as we say, it's normally coming down over the North Atlantic, we see them being intercepted. Don't see many from up in Alaska, but that's a great shot.
It is a great shot. Well, I mean, most of the pictures came because the US military puts all its photographs are available by either the US National Archive or each service has its own sort of photo thing. Then there's the US Naval History Department have got loads and loads of photographs. So there's no end of really fascinating photographs around about. It's really trying to sort of narrow it down to, I think there's, I can't remember how we put it, 200 and somewhere between 200 and 240, I think, photographs there and we tried to get a photograph of every single aircraft type as well, which I think we've managed to do.
So if
the names are in print somewhere, there's a picture of it, so what it looks like.
And
as you say, I think the picture paints 1,000 words, as it were, and it's just fantastic to see what these things look like, as I say, marvel at stuff like the Cutlass, some bizarre looking machine if ever there was one.
Yeah. The Brits knew how to come up with something a bit different, didn't they?
Yeah.
even things like the Buccaneer, which most people didn't think was a very attractive aircraft, but so effective at the role that it undertook.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it was a fantastic machine, really. I know it was very successful over land as well, but yes, particularly as a carrier-based strike aircraft, it was fantastic.
Hmm. I define all these aircraft by the Airfix models that I made or wanted for Christmas or a birthday or something like that. That's where most of them come from. And the one that springs to mind that I never did was the Vigilante.
Oh, no, nor me, no.
What an amazing aircraft that is. It's ginormous.
Looked way too big to be on an aircraft carrier. I'm sorry, much too big.
Yeah. It does make you wonder why they kept them, really, because yeah, they used them for recce. We thought you'd just stick a pod on a Phantom or something.
Yeah.
Off you go. But they had these huge, great machines that went off.
And yeah. talking about some of the events, we mentioned the Cuba earlier.
Yeah.
Mike, how did naval aviation come into play at crises like that?
Well, that one particularly, it was sort of doing the naval blockade and using airplanes to locate submarines, which they did actually. I think there were something like five Soviet submarines that all got tracked. One of them reckoned he'd got away, but the story was that he was actually tracked all the way. But yeah, I mean, it was that thing of locating submarines in mid-Atlantic. And these lines of patrol lines that were put out to actually stop and find a Soviet submarine. So that again, given as I say that the emphasis really on keeping track of all the missile submarines. Whenever there was any crisis, then immediately, of course, everybody wants to know where are the submarines, and do we have an airplane there? Are we covering each submarine that we know of?
And technology was evolving at a rapid pace as well throughout that period as well, and being introduced, and using that term Gareth used earlier of cat and mouse, it was quite interesting. You'd have an aircraft developed, and then a submarine innovation would drive another change in technology, and it would just continually evolve at such a rapid pace. What sort of technologies do you think in naval aircraft directly influenced the Cold War and the outcomes that we saw?
A lot of things like radar, for example, the search water radar and the Nimrod, which could pick up tiny little radar returns, and the sonar technology, which changed, and particularly sonar processing technology was the big thing, that you could drop these things into the water, and you then have sufficient sort of computing power. The P3, I think, was the first one that had this massive sort of computer on board that could work out what it was you were listening to. They did have recordings of all the Soviet submarines. So you'd listen to the distinctive bits of the machinery, and they'd know exactly which vessel it was. So all that side of the anti-submarine side of things. I mean, again, the Soviets started using more things like magnetic anomaly detectors and stuff like that with the IL-38, the May maritime patrol aircraft, which actually came into the story sort of quite late on, really. They'd used a Bear, which again, the naval version of maritime, the Bear F, was sort of like late 70s. They got into the sort of proper sub-hunting bit really quite late on in the game. I don't know how effective they were, but I guess thinking about sort of carrier-borne aircraft, again, the helicopter, which came on leaps and bounds from being a sort of fairly poxial thing to things like Sea Kings with twin-engine things with radars and pilots and God knows what else, were quite amazing, really, the sort of technology and capability of them. So I think that's the helicopters, as mentioned, Tom, was probably the thing that came on leaps and bounds more than anything else.
Mike, you were a ground attack pilot on the Tornado GR1, but in any of those larger exercises you took part in, did you work with, or do any of these sorts of assets take part in any of those exercises?
I'm just trying to think. No, we didn't really, because we really were sort of because I was on the UK. I was in the Germany based squadrons, and so our role was completely overland. I think some of the UK squadrons may have done some stuff with the Navy, and obviously the air defence guys did a lot of work with the Navy in terms of air defence and of course there were also there were two. Initially Buccaneer, and then later, well, actually, there were two Buccaneer anti-shipping squadrons. I was going to say later Tornado, that was actually post-Cold War. Those were land-based, and obviously when the carrier went, they took over the role. They obviously couldn't reach quite as far. But, the RAF was or did participate in those exercises and also what was involved in maritime operations.
I was just... Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Gareth.
I was just wondering, I know you did some, you did Red Flags, you did Transatlantics, yeah, et cetera. Just from a pilot's point of view, what's it like operating over water for long periods of time? Pretty featureless, very different, I should imagine, to flying over land.
Well, yeah, very much so. I mean, I have to say that I didn't actually fly the Atlantic because, again, when I started off in Germany, we were not we didn't use air to air refueling. So when the aircraft went across the Atlantic, the UK squadrons would fly them out there for us. But yeah, you're right. I mean, even flying over the Mediterranean, where there's a lot of not very much. You don't know what it is. You hope that your inertial nav system works and your navigator knows what he's up to, knows his arse from his elbow, as they say. But other than that, you don't really have much of a clue. And again, there's nowhere to hide. There's no trees to hide behind or anything like that either. So you're kind of a bit naked.
Mike, we've talked a fair bit about, I suppose, nuclear deterrence. You know, hunting the nuclear subs and that sort of thing. But early on, we talked about the American philosophy of the carrier strike group. How about naval aviation and projection, how that evolved during the Cold War? I mean, towards the end, of course, we saw the Falklands and events like that. How did you see that whole process evolve?
Again, I think that the roots of it were in Korea, where the kind of Americans worked out how to do it, and then again into Vietnam, and actually that was one of the interesting things. Although again, both of those kind of lie outside the scope of the book. I did put some. I did write some bits about the fact that most of the, I think some of the carriers, I think all the carriers did at least a tour of. Some only did one, but some of them did something like 10 or so, which is quite interesting to see. So it became a very sort of well-worn path, I think. And so they use the same plan and say, right, that's what we're going to do at Norway. So, come the war, the strike group is going to head off up to Norway, to the northern flank, which was always reckoned to be one of the vulnerable points of NATO. And it's going to reinforce the northern flank. So you've now got an aircraft carrier with, 80 plus aeroplanes on it. So you've actually got an extra airfield, an extra sort of, strike wing there. At which again has got the range to project power, as you say, all the way probably across into Russia and into Murmansk and the areas there where the submarines were based. So it certainly gave you the ability to reinforce somewhere like that with a very credible and powerful force. And effectively, we did the same thing down in the Falklands, really. Part of the carriers just firing off so they weren't vulnerable, and send them in to first cover air defence for the landings, and also give again, I think it was less because there wasn't the weather wasn't really up to it, but air support for the ground forces. It's certainly from looking at Norway and saying, well, there aren't many airfields there and it'd be difficult to operate, suddenly you've now got another massive great big sort of influx of aircraft, or possibly two aircraft carriers or something coming in there. Suddenly, the balance of power has changed very, very quickly and very dramatically.
And you mentioned Norway there, Mike.
Yeah.
You do also cover. We've obviously focused quite heavily on the Royal Navy, the Americans, and so forth. But you cover, you mentioned Norway, you cover France, Germany, Italy, Holland, Netherlands, Sweden. I'm allowed to call it Holland. I'm half
Dutch. I think
that
bit is Holland where the bases were.
I thought it was really fascinating how those naval air arms also developed, sometimes under the wing of the Americans, particularly with the hardware, but not always.
The French always do their own thing, and indeed they did. Although they did fly the F-8 Crusader for a long while off their two carriers, but yeah, they went their own way, but have always been very serious about having traditional aircraft carriers in a way that we weren't, I don't think. So that's interesting that they've kept on going. The Canadians, of course, had a carrier, but it just got too expensive in the end. And it kind of the capabilities were overtaken by the helicopters, as we said. So there was actually no point in them. They had this carrier with Banshees and trackers on, and then it became pointless because actually you could cover it much better with helicopters, and with long range patrol aircraft. So that went the way of being too expensive. And the same thing really happened with the Dutch as well with their carrier. They had Seahawks and I can't remember Avengers, I think, on it, and trackers as well. They certainly had, I can't remember if they operated them off the carriers or not, off the top of my head. Both those navies had carriers and gave them up because largely I think because they're too expensive, but also because actually the job could be done much better by the helicopter or by long range aircraft based on the land. Each of those navies, stroke air forces, or maritime side of it was different. The Germans, for example, were really concentrating on what's happening in the Baltic. So that's their interest is, well, what do we need in the Baltic, and what's the threat there? Well, threats, the sort of Soviet small ships and amphibious stuff. So we got something that can take those out. The Danes again also had their F-100s. I think could be equipped with missiles. Again, aimed at stopping amphibious forces sort of working their way up through the Baltic. So those countries were very much based on, on the threat to them in the Baltic. Italy again. I think one of the interesting things of Italy again was airplane. I think they bought some airplanes for the Navy, and then the government said, "Oh no, if it's a fixed wing airplane, it has to be run by the Air Force." Okay, and that's another reason why they then bought helicopters, because the Air Force said, "Oh yeah, don't worry about helicopters; we're not interested in those."
Yeah,
and I think a similar thing happened in Spain as well.
Yeah,
but again, each country, depending on where it was and what the sort of the geographic peculiarities were, their maritime aviation sort of developed in a slightly different way. But as I say, all parts of NATO, when they were in NATO, Spain is the one I'm thinking of there, which wasn't and then was, it became interoperable. So despite those different sort of the way things had evolved differently, they did all work together seamlessly and very well.
If you could pick out one aircraft type from each side, one from Soviet, one from the NATO, that you felt was the most influential during the Cold War, I think I know what the NATO one would possibly be. But one from each side, do you think, really influenced the outcomes of naval aviation in the Cold War?
Well, I think that the Tu-95 Bear is definitely the one on the Soviet side, because that was the kind of ubiquitous reconnaissance, but more particularly targeting aircraft, again, with massive flexibility because of its performance and its size and range. The massive radar on it to locate targets, and then all the radio equipment to then pass on mid-course corrections and things to missiles. And so it was a beast, really, and one that did pose a massive threat to certainly to carrier strike groups, to surface vessels of all sorts, but also to submarines as well. For the reasons that we said. So I think the Bear definitely becomes the sort of the iconic sort of Soviet type. As to NATO, probably something like the P-3 for similar reasons. I mean, that was a very, very competent and capable airplane as an anti-submarine warfare airplane. The more I thought about it, the more I thought that's probably in NATO the more important role that aircraft played was hunting down the Soviet submarines. So I suppose one might argue that perhaps the Sea King should be, Sea King or the P-3, which was operated in numerous or great numbers by the Americans, but also by other the Dutch and the Norwegians. I think the Spanish had some for a while. Other NATO nations as well. So probably those. As I say, it's great. Yes, the whole sexy thing is aircraft carriers and smacking on and firing them off on the catapult and into the arrestor wire and all the rest of it. But actually, the donkeys, the real sort of coalface, real work was being done by the big, less exciting aeroplanes, hunting submarines.
Mike, it's interesting, isn't it? Just to bring things forward to the current day.
Oh yes.
Whether it's political mismanagement or military mismanagement. But for the UK, we got out of the carrier game and also the anti-submarine game and had a large capability gap. And now we're back in it, aren't we? We've got two aircraft carriers. We've got the P-8 Poseidon. And so it's almost like it's come back into fashion again.
Well, yeah, but I think the critical thing that I still I think was criminal was actually to have that braking capability against the submarines. And it wasn't that there was a great threat at the time, but that the expertise, I think, a lot of the expertise has been lost. And that's a really critical thing when you think that probably the most important thing. And the question really was it more important for us to have the ability to monitor the Soviet submarines, which in that time also did lots of reconnaissance of underwater infrastructure? I mean, that's one of the big things when I came to look back on what's happened since, is all the kind of sabotage work and preparations for that that's been done by Soviet underwater stuff, completely unmonitored by us because we lost the ability to do it. Should we have been doing that and concentrating our own defense rather than, one might say, prattling around in Afghanistan and places like that? So, it's an interesting, it was a political decision, but given an either or, I think that, and particularly now with the benefit of hindsight and seeing where we are now and who we're looking at now, it really was not a good decision to get rid of that. I mean, the carriers are another really interesting thing because I don't know what they're for, because they don't really fit into either the anti-submarine thing or the strike wing. Because if you're going to have a carrier strike wing, if you go and park USS whatever offshore with 100 airplanes on it, that's going to take names and kick ass. Some people are going to notice that. If you pitch up with, you've got 12 F-35s or whatever on it, people are going to go, really? and not only F-35s, but the ones that don't go very far. And your one carrier that, that carrier, what are you going to protect him with? I can't help thinking that money would have been better spent on, buying a lot more anti-submarine frigates.
Was it the big stick destroyers that they were christened in America? I mean, we back in the day, the carrier was the big stick, wasn't it? And we probably don't have the biggest stick, do we, with our carrier and its relatively small amount of aircraft on board.
No, but that's the thing. When I looked at, it's interesting. Really interesting, actually, their names. So Queen Elizabeth and Prince of Wales, which were the names of the two carriers that the Navy was going to have in the 1960s that got cancelled. So this is it's a victory for the Navy over the enemy. The enemy being the RAF, but it's a Pyrrhic victory. I think it's I do despair really. I can't think what they're for in terms of, because they don't really project power in the way that perhaps a big aircraft carrier ought to. And similarly, that they're too big for, you could get away with much smaller vessels and more of them for anti-submarine work, which is what we really need to do. What we really need to do is to keep the lines of communication clear, and also hunt down the Russian missile boats, and that's one of the things again that I found really interesting was looking at that and seeing how times have changed. Because I did mention it in the book that there was an American spy ring who passed a whole lot of secrets on to the Russians about submarine construction at the same time as, I think it was either a Norwegian or a Japanese company sold some milling equipment to the Russians, which enabled them to mill really accurate propellers. And so they reduced the noise that come off these Soviet, now Russian, boats. And the result is that you end up where the detection range of a submarine is dramatically less. It makes an awful lot less noise. So that means that you need to drop more sonar buoys to find it. But sonar buoys are bloody expensive. And as budgets have gone down, the days of going out with 100 sonar buoys and dropping them all, it's difficult to justify that now. But if you don't do that, you're not going to find the submarines. And as global warming or climate change, or whatever you want to call it, has taken place, so as the Atlantic or the polar ice cap disappears or reduces in the summer months, so you've got a massive, bigger area where Soviet submarines can hide in their kind of defended bastion. So they're actually now, they've got more space to hide. They're actually much closer to Murmansk. So they're under cover of, you know, ships and aircraft operating from there. So they're so much more difficult to get hold of, because you've got to run the gauntlet now of the defences, as well as trying to find these needles in a massive great big haystack. So, you know, the fact that we stepped away from all that, it was really, I think, quite criminal. And as I say, where the carriers come into that and how they're going to help, I really still don't see.
Okay, well, there we go. One more general question for you, Mike, just before we start to wrap up. And it's going on the theme we've just talked about, really. How do you see the evolution of autonomy affecting naval aviation? Obviously, well,
The thing that I took on board big time was that is the way to go. It's drones, UAVs, whatever you want to call them, you know, big ones. But that's how you, because for, you know, a lot of reconnaissance and that kind of work is kind of long and boring and repetitive, and you don't really necessarily need a human on board. Tracking a submarine is really quite, you know, it's very tactical. So it's the cat and mouse chess game. And so if you can divest yourself of all the routine tasks using unmanned aircraft, and then concentrate your forces on those where you actually need the human brain in there to work out what's going on and work out the tactics. But yes, everybody's using and looking at drones. And one of the things I when I looked at it was the thought, really, that perhaps the Soviet naval air arm doesn't need to exist, because just about everything it does can be done better now by drones. And so, you know, your long range loitering drone is the thing, really, that you need. You perhaps don't need you know, expensive airplane flying around, burning holes in the sky and massively crewed doing really quite routine jobs. So yeah, that's it. That was what I thought. I really do think that the future, certainly for the Soviet naval aviation side of thing, is unmanned, and probably for an awful lot of what you know, the routine tasks that are done. Also, it's unmanned aircraft, which of course for all of us aircraft enthusiasts is a really awful thing, isn't it? Because we like real airplanes.
Mike, this has been such a fascinating conversation on this subject, but you've been busy typing as well, haven't you? You've got
I've just been filling.
No, not tonight, but just generally, you've got this is not the only Mike Napier book that is on the near horizon. What else should we be looking out for?
Yeah, well, as I said, I've been so lucky because I've ended up with a couple of commissioning editors who sort of, you know, quite like my style or whatever. So I keep getting being asked to do things. So Cold War Seas comes out on the 22nd of May, which is also the same day as one on the Jaguar. And this is a 100-page softback book from the Osprey combat aircraft series, which are the ones which have got the, you know, sort of all the color profiles and all the rest of it, and it's, yeah, so that was fascinating doing Jaguar, because it covered not only the Gulf War, but then also subsequent operations over the Balkans, which are, you know, exciting stuff. So that comes out soon. I've done one which is I'm not quite sure when it's going to be published. I think perhaps later on this year, or perhaps early next year, which is for the Osprey air campaigns thing, which is about the air campaign over Iraq in 2003. Which again is an interesting one, because that was one where all the lessons that have ever been learned all got put together, and we see a sort of exactly how air warfare came of age, really. And I'm just on the same as the Lightning, the combat aircraft one, just finishing one on the English Electric Lightning, which again is one of those iconic airplanes. So which again, and the fascinating thing about the Lightning was I thought, well, what, because the other ones in combat were quite easy, actually, in that it was defined, you know, the Gulf War, the Balkans, you know, various other things, you know, Iraq, Iran after the Gulf War, blah, blah, blah. But so what do you do about the Cold War? And so what I just went into was actually the intercepts that were done. So again, you're talking about, you know, launching out Lucas and, you know, finding you know, a bear sort of, you know, 200 miles north. And so it's interesting looking at all those actually and that sort of thing. So again, that's another, and the other thing about the, you know, the lightning is, of course, there's all those wonderful color schemes from the 1960s when they colored them in all sorts of things. And I did actually find the very snotty letter from the CNC Fighter Command saying, you are not to paint your airplanes like this anymore. You've broken the rule. now they're going to be the following markings, which is quite funny. So that's going, and I'm just literally started one, which will, I've got to hand in at the end of the year, so I guess it will be sort of midway through next year, which is looking at a Lancaster squadron, a 24-hour cycle, or a Lancaster base, which I don't think has been done that way before. So again, it's a sort of chronological look through, 8 o'clock in the morning, what's everybody doing, what's happening, the chronology of how raid got planned and briefed, and then actually, you know, how the aircraft got serviced and bombed up and all that stuff. Who was doing what in the operations block, and then, you know, then getting airborne, flying the mission, coming back, debriefing, etc. So that, I think, again, to be quite an interesting one. And one, again, that we're going to aim to put in lots of pictures in the same way that we did with Cold War Seas. Because, as mentioned, a picture paints 1,000 words, but also it does make it a much more kind of attractive thing to look at and read if you've got any nice pictures that to cover the interest as well. So yeah, so that actually, I think Lancaster will be book number 20 when that comes out. So
wow.
I've become quite prolific, as you say.
So I wanted to ask you actually, Mike. I think I told you on WhatsApp in the build up to tonight that I've recently reread Tornado Over the Tigris. I'm a sucker for rereading books that I like. I'll revisit them endlessly and periodically.
F4 Phantom and Pilot stories.
Exactly.
He's rereading every year.
I can't help but wonder if we were able to go back and speak to Mike Napier, Tornado GR1 pilot, and tell him that he would be an author with 20 plus books under his belt, what he would have thought about that.
He's gone, nah, you're kidding me. I think you'd have been chuffed, really, but yeah, I don't suppose you believe word of it.
So it wasn't, was this, did you ever have this in mind, or did it literally, as you said, come about because you wrote that squadron history and went from there? Was there a seed at any point that this was
going to be? To be honest with you, I'd always wanted to write. And in fact, oddly enough, the book about the Lightning and the Lancaster too, as a kid, I always wanted to write a book about the Lightning. And I think Lancaster's fantastic. I'd love to be able to write a book about it. And so finally, sort of 60 years later, actually probably 50 years later, I've achieved that kind of ambition. So yeah, I think there was always an ambition to do it. So I'm very delighted that it has actually sort of... taken off, and I've actually been able to do it, and I really enjoy it as well. I mean, I find it absolutely fascinating researching these things and finding things out I didn't really know about. And I mean, that's the whole Cold War Seas thing, was it? You know, the whole maritime aviation thing was new to me, and I think what I can bring to it is that understanding of being an aviator myself, but at the same time, I like to think I'm not biased, despite the rude comments I made earlier on about Nimrod pilots and about the present two aircraft carriers. But I like to think that I kind of have an open mind and I'm not sort of constrained or biased anyway. So I hope I can produce something that is complete and objective in its thing, and hopefully readable as well. But you never know.
Oh, well, they're definitely readable. We need you to keep writing them so that we can keep reading them, because we then get the chance to talk about them. So that's how it works for us. So brilliant.
Yeah. Mike, as we wrap up, for those who aren't following you, where can we find you online?
You can find me online. I do have a website which I need to update because it's about 5 years out of date, which I think is mjwnapier.com. But I am on Twitter, and that is Michael N. Books. And that's probably the main thing I use. I do have an author page on Facebook as well, which I probably need to update as well.
Okay.
But yeah, probably Twitter.
The book is due out just around the time this airs, so nicely timed, and we'll look forward to seeing if we can get you back on to talk about Jaguars, Lightnings and Lancasters. Okay. I think sometime we've got to, haven't we? It's got to be done.
I'd be delighted. So it's always a pleasure talking about these things, and it's great to be able to talk about it with like-minded people.
Thank you. So that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts for our music, and you can find Ellie and Tim on the Extended Facebook, Twitter, Threads, Instagram, X. Have I missed anything, Gareth? Pages?
No, I think that's all of it.
And where can we find you, Gareth?
Best place to head is for globalaviationresource.com. You can search for us on Facebook as well, and hopefully you'll find we're a bit more active than we've been in the past few months.
And you can find me at Nascot Hornet on most social media platforms as well. That's it with Arrival of the Music. It's goodbye from Mike.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from Gareth.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.